Looking for the perfect getaway in the heart of Red Rock Country? Discover Grand Plateau RV Resort in Kanab, Utah, where comfort meets adventure. Spacious RV sites, luxury cabins, and top-tier amenities make every stay unforgettable. Take a dip in the heated pool, relax in the spa, or unwind with private restrooms and pickleball too. Minutes from Zion, Bryce Canyon, and the Grand Canyon, Grand Plateau RV Resort is your ideal base camp for exploring the Southwest's natural wonders. And when the day winds down, enjoy starry skies and peaceful nights under the desert sky. Adventure, comfort, and convenience. That's Grand Plateau RV Resort. Book your stay today at gprvresort.com.
Hey everybody, it's Kate from Med Crimes. Before we dive into part one, I wanted to take a brief moment to give some additional context. After the initial release, we received a lot of feedback about our referencing of the Netflix documentary, Taking Care of Maya. In part one of the series, we really only get into Maya and her family's background, family life, and early on in her illness. The documentary, as it's a great examination of Maya's situation from her and her family's point of view and perspective, is a great source of information for this episode. We are very aware that this documentary, made by Netflix, is heavily influenced by Maya and her family's perspective on the case. Many other important facts were merely glazed over or omitted entirely, and there is a great wealth of evidence and facts supporting the healthcare workers in this case. As in the coming parts, we will finally be discussing Maya's hospitalization. We will absolutely be reviewing all evidence and facts in the case, in an effort to be, as always, as unbiased as possible. Furthermore, we are acutely aware of the precedent these lawsuits are setting and the impact that this could have on healthcare workers and other mandated reporters, which we will also discuss in detail. And with that, let's get started on part one.
Hey everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Shenanigans for you guys.
Shenanigans.
A series. It's time. It's time for a series. Three-potter.
We love a good Kate series.
We love us a three-potter.
Speaking of, thank you all for bearing with us when we missed a little episode 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, you guys are the bomb.
Just want to, again, we couldn't thank you guys enough. We couldn't thank you enough. You know, this hobby has grown more than either of us ever thought possible.
Yep.
When she first asked me, hey, do you want to record a podcast?
And she said, what's a podcast?
And I said, yes, just thinking that's never going to fucking happen. So, you know, and just with our young families and stuff, it still can be a little tough sometimes. So
yeah,
just thank you for bearing with us on the times that we just
need to step away from.
Don't always have our shit together.
Exactly. Our shit is apart. Like, what's that saying? Like, I don't have my ducks in a row. There are squirrels and they're all like on crack and there's something like that.
Squirrel!
That's what's going on. That is just how things are going. But we have Patreons.
We love our Patreons.
You guys are basically little stars in the sky. We have a Christine Caldwell.
Hi, Christine.
Hey, hey, hey. And we have Mary Hebert.
Oh, welcome to the family, girls.
Listen, ladies. Okay, you know what mythical creature you guys are? You guys are Zendaya at the Met Gala. Did you see her floral?
That was pretty mythical.
I mean,
just like Kim Kardashian's waist.
Yes.
That's pretty mythical.
Go big or go home, or go tiny or go home.
I guess I'm always staying home. I don't even get to leave the house. Yes. My waist is not so tiny.
I'm in my sweats on the couch going, oh my God, she looks Doja Cat in her wet t-shirt. She looks ridiculous and terrible. Meanwhile, I'm literally in sweats. Literally in sweats.
We're not YouTubing today. I apologize.
Oh, yeah.
So you,
I don't apologize.
No, we don't actually apologize. It's just not happening tonight. But y'all don't get to see my One Tree Hill trick sweatshirt that I'm wearing.
And you guys don't get to see my puffy fucking face that has no makeup on it because, wow. So we are going to dive into this three-part series on a situation that I think was more in the media sort of the end of last year, because the trial had been ongoing and there are still some legal proceedings that are happening with this. I'm even seeing articles from the, you know, past few days on,
yep. Yeah, I have
on
too.
Things that are coming out. And Devin actually knows this story a little bit because we talked a little bit.
Because I just couldn't wait.
She just couldn't wait.
I just couldn't wait.
And this is a story that, so me and Brad actually sat down and watched the documentary Taking Care of Maya, which is on Netflix. And if you haven't seen it, please go watch it. It's incredible. We just wanted to throw the TV out the window while we were watching it because it was just so infuriating and sad and hopeless and devastating for the people and involved.
It's insane when I watched, and because when you had said the title to me a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. I was like, isn't that the Munchausen case?
Mm-hmm.
Because like, that's just what I.
Yes.
But then obviously you're going to listen when we get to it. And it's just like, that's what is associated
exactly.
with it. And it's so not at all. And
no.
It's pretty appalling.
It's really very sad. And I think we as healthcare personnel can kind of understand what, you know, what might have happened in our minds, because we work it and we live it. We see it every day. And we'll get into it, but it's just, you know, it's just a lot, and it's interesting. So I feel like this deserved like a really, really deep dive. And so we're going to start with part one now.
Part one.
So this story, there are some trigger warnings here. There's heavy themes of a very true, very valid childhood illness, medical trauma, medical kidnapping, child abuse, and then there are also themes of suicide throughout this series, which we're not going to get into today. This today is going to be more sort of like laying the groundwork, going into Maya's parents, their history, their backgrounds.
What was going on with Maya?
Was going on with Maya? Yep. So this the whole story is just like a shocking study how one person's idea or opinion or incorrect assumption can just like stick with a patient and follow them indefinitely throughout their experience. Exactly. And it within the medical community.
And not a well thought out opinion either.
No, it's not. And it's something we as a whole in medicine need to like get better at, because we see it all the time. I see it a lot. And I'm actually going to start with like a little brief story, if nobody minds. And by nobody, I mean Devin. Do you mind, Devin?
I'm the only one here.
She's the only one here. Does she mind?
No.
Okay, Devin doesn't mind. So one of the most important lessons I learned from a mentor that I had when I was learning how to do inpatient medicine, when I started my first job as a nurse practitioner, as a hospitalist in acute care, was think for yourself. Because you are going to be assuming care of patients that have, you know, been in the hospital for several days. And make sure what you're seeing on the patient and in terms of doc and like data and documentation, all of that makes sense with each other. Because once in a while, you're going to get a patient who somebody's opinion just kind of stuck and nobody else wanted to think of outside that tiny little box.
Like whoever saw them first. Like
exactly.
That's their...
So this exact scenario happened to me. So I had a patient when I was working in the hospital who had been hospitalized for 3 days. They were on hospital day 3 for cellulitis in his left leg. This is a true story. The initial diagnosis, they were admitted for cellulitis because they had a history of cellulitis on this leg. And they had tried outpatient antibiotics. It didn't work. So they were admitted, started on IV antibiotics. Now it's been 3 days. I'm seeing this patient who's been on IV antibiotics for 3 days. Nothing is getting better. The provider before me had broadened their antibiotic coverage, meaning mm-hmm. that they're including more, you know, antibiosis, yeah. more organisms, and done a soft tissue ultrasound to ensure that they didn't have a fluid collection as a reason why that might not be getting better, because sometimes you have to drain those in order for it to get better, which they did not. So I'm starting from scratch here. I'm looking over all of their labs from the mm-hmm. day they were admitted. I'm looking through all the pictures because they take photos. He never had a white count. He never had a fever. He never had sepsis markers that would have alerted us to like a severe infection. His inflammatory markers were a little elevated. His neutrophil count was like flat. So like from a bacterial infection standpoint, like why am I not really seeing anything that like is really pointing to bacterial infection here? Because I'm just not seeing it. He had a D-dimer in the ER, which was mildly elevated, not alarmingly so, not wildly elevated. So I took that advice from my mentor that day, and I started thinking, what if this person does not have cellulitis at all? Because it didn't fit perfectly. Like, this was not a slam dunk. It was an odd presentation. It didn't make perfect sense. So I took that advice, and I was like, you know what? I see this guy. His leg is huge. It's swollen. It's red. It's super tender. They did that soft tissue ultrasound, but they never did a vascular study on that leg. So I got a vascular study and first thing in the morning when I saw him the first time. And by that afternoon, we knew that he had a massive DVT.
Holy shit.
From his ankle to his thigh.
Whoa.
And I started him on heparin, and then we transitioned to oral anticoagulants, and the guy went home feeling much better. Stopped antibiotics. It was never cellulitis.
Wow.
So
I'm so stinking proud of you.
Well, you know, so I have
you
my moments.
For yourself.
Well, that's the thing. You think for yourself. The thing is, it's in this scenario, nobody ever really wanted to think outside this little pigeonhole
box. That it
box,
could be something else.
That it could
other than what they're saying it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. So everybody, think for yourself. And who knows? Maybe I really did save this guy, because like, he could have gotten a PE or shot, you know
the
what
next
I mean
day, and they could have just been doing more antibiotics and antibiotics
exactly
the day off.
So you know, yeah, I know, thank god I didn't have the day
thank
off,
god
right?
I didn't have the day off.
So I mean, that's just like an example of sort of like what we're going to get into here. So we're going to start with how the Kowalskis came to be. So Maya Kowalski is the child in question here. She's the daughter of Jack and Beata Kowalski. So Beata is Maya's mom. She came to the U.S. from communist Poland when she was only 16 years old. Her parents really did not have much. They were essentially like political refugees at the time. So they arrived in the Chicago area, and she started high school in Chicago. So she's 16 years old, like brand new to the country. By all accounts, was a great kid, never got in any trouble. Did amazing at school too, was like really good at it. And Jack actually would tell the story in this documentary that we watched, that somebody at the school, like one of her teachers, once told her that like, you're never really going to make it in this country because like, you're like an immigrant who
barely speaks
yeah. English.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, okay, actually, here's
hold my beer.
And she just like went on to learn to speak the language beautifully, and she did everything like
and made a career for herself
and just like absolutely killed it, like despite the language barrier. So she like did very well in all of her classes. I mean, honestly, was just a wonderful kid. Beata was tenacious. She was eager to learn anything somebody said she couldn't do. She just like did it anyway, 10 times better than she was expected to do it. So she loved proving people wrong, proving her worth. And if she was thinking something, you would know about it. Like, she was the type of person who would just like, would not keep it inside. She's not going to internalize. She's going to tell you how she feels about this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
She wore her heart on her sleeve. She loved fiercely. And these are the things that like really like Jack like fell in love with when he met her.
Bold.
I know, right? So Beata, after high school, went and put herself through college in Chicago, nursing school, in fact, and having only 2 years earlier moved to the U.S. and only recently learned English.
It's phenomenal.
She just like that. I mean, this was not an easy endeavor. Nursing school is
you got to learn a whole lot of medical language,
and
let alone the English language.
Exactly. But she fucking worked, bitch, and she put herself through school, and she graduated at the top of her class. She tested, she got her RN, and she started her career at Loyola University Medical Center in
Good
Chicago as a registered nurse. Her first job was in the cardiac cath lab, which like, I mean, that's a very techie, very hands-on, very intense job, very high stress. And she thrived in that environment. Like,
that's
she
amazing.
She loved it. So soon after this, her and Jack, now having been in a relationship, relocate to Florida and kind of settle down there and start there. And that's where they, you know, get married and start, you know, thinking about building a family. And Jack started working there as a firefighter in Florida around this time. And he was a career firefighter. Jack stated, quote, one of the things that she really had always wanted was to have a child. And when it was happening, she would decorate, she would go out and buy clothes. And I just always knew that she would be this wonderful mother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because we know she just like loves fiercely, and she's just like this person who just like, she just wants to you know, give that love to somebody.
All comes naturally.
Exactly.
To her too.
She's just one of those people that was like born to be a mom. I mean, we know
Just like us.
Just like us. It's so cute. And then, like,
happy Mother's Day also. Oh, wow. God,
yeah.
Wicked
How
tangent.
Did we not say that?
And Nurses Week.
So happy Mother's Day and Nurses Week.
And next week is National Nursing Home Week.
For also,
all
thank you, teachers. Teachers, too.
Where have we been?
What is going on? This wow. should have been addressed initially, like, very early
10
on.
Minutes ago.
Well, I'm sorry. And, like, we know that Beata is, like, going to be this mama bear type mom.
Love
right?
that.
So she's like, I mean, right off the bat, like, we know she's going to be like, I love you, but also, like, I will scratch your fucking eyes out if you mess with my kid.
I love that.
That's,
I
like, mean, the type I mean, of person she is, right? So Maya was Jack and Beata's firstborn. She was born December 10th, 2005, and Beata and Jack just, like, fell in love with being parents, and just, it came very naturally to both of them. So, of course, Beata is this incredible mom. Jack later said in an interview, quote, we always made sure that Maya had the best of everything, the best shoes, the best clothes. She even went to Polish school as a child so she could start learning the language. I know. So he also said that her mom would, like, write little notes back and forth. So when Maya was little, she would, like, you know, put little notes in her lunchbox and just, like, you know, do all those very cutesy, like, mom things, like the just, like, extra mile to, like, show you that I'm thinking of you and I love you. I know,
I probably should.
We suck. Happy Mother's Day. So another thing about Beata that we will see is kind of a common theme is that she documented everything, and this started before the illness, before the event. I wonder if this came from, like, nursing school, because, you know, as nurses, we are taught to document literally everything. Mm-hmm. So even
but
to
I
the
also
point,
I wonder if it's like a mother's instinct, too, because I mean, when you think about it, too, like, you know, when our kids are sick, we're pretty on point with, like, it started 100%. With this. And yes. This is what happened. And yeah. I mean, I Maya agree. Had a lot of things starting to happen. So,
I agree.
You know, for her to just start to keep track to help, you know.
Oh, yeah. But I think even before that, though, there was, like, she would keep journals of, like, all of these little milestones and, like, all of these little things, any trip or special day thing that they did together. She would, like, write the date and exactly what they did and the times. Like, she was a diligent documenter, like, when things were, like,
my baby
boring.
Books for my children are still pending.
Yeah. So 2 years after Maya's birth, her brother Kyle is born. And they were just, like, the super happy, like, loving family. They had this beautiful home. Beautiful neighborhood.
And they're a beautiful looking family.
Oh my God. If you just Google them, they are just, like, this gorgeous set of human beings.
They have their daughter, their son, a beautiful marriage.
Beautiful.
Living the dream.
Wonderful. So now fast forward to the spring of 2015. Beata is working as a home infusion RN. And Maya at this point is 9 years old. Jack had been working as a firefighter, but actually had recently taken an early retirement package. So he was starting to collect on his pension. He was spending a lot more time at home with the kids, which was awesome for the family because Beata could still work. So he got to spend a lot more time with the kids. So Jack and Beata start noticing some changes in Maya around this time. Maya starts complaining of a great deal of generalized pain, and the primary complaint at the time seems to be pain in her abdomen, her legs, and her feet. This very quickly was, like, far beyond any normal, like, joint pain, pulled muscle, over fatigue, growing pains, anything that you know, commonly ails children her age. So, of course, Beata immediately is, like, getting her into the doctor, trying to figure things out. Of course, the first assumption is that she's a kid. She pulled some muscles. Maybe she has a virus that's bogging her down. Give her some time. Let her rest, relax, rehydrate, get better with some time. All that rigmarole. Of course, she does not get better.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
gets worse. And this starts becoming a daily thing. And it becomes so debilitating that she was starting to spend days in bed. She was missing school, and eventually they had to pull her out of school because of
this. Can we talk about how terrifying that is as a parent?
Oh my God. I actually have, it's funny you said that, because I have that written in here, like, how hopeless and helpless you must feel as a parent when your child, there's something very wrong, and we'll get into it more, but
I mean,
like,
your normal, healthy, she was nine? Like, 9 year old daughter, you know, playing her sports, her soccer, whatnot, and then all of a sudden now she, like, is in bed.
I mean, this totally interrupted everyone in this family's entire lives. I mean, this was very debilitating, and it gets worse. And soon this pain gets so bad that she's not able to walk or bear weight on her limbs. And she's starting to like spend days in bed because she physically can't walk. And it's not like, oh, this just hurts too much. It's like she physically cannot.
Her feet were like pointing inwards. They got the bow legged.
So what starts to happen, and we'll get into that too. So of course, this is very frustrating for her family because something is very wrong with my kid. This is not normal. And as a parent, you know that this isn't normal. This isn't my kid. My kid's, you know, doesn't just like do this. Like, this is not normal because you know your kid. And when you're a healthcare provider, you know, you don't know that. You don't know that kid. So you just kind of make your best guess and you go with that. So like, I do understand where they're coming from with like, you know, just let's try the supportive care thing. Let's wait it out. Let's see what happens. Because all of this is very vague. Like of all course. Of these complaints are very vague.
Nothing's
I get
pinpointing.
That. 100%. So Beata and Jack are still taking Maya to the doctor consistently and things are not getting better. And in fact, it is starting to deteriorate and get worse. So finally, doctors are starting to, okay, let's do some testing. Let's try to, let's draw some labs. Let's do some basic imaging. Let's try to figure out what's going on. She has some labs. Everything is all pretty basic stuff, but it's all very reassuring. Everything comes back negative. So as of right now, there's really no great medical explanation for what's going on.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But frustrating.
Exactly. And then again, they start down this pattern of the more they go to the doctor, they start getting all these referrals to different specialists. And now it's a bunch of different doctors that are involved. And they see a neurologist, they see an immunologist, and nobody has a great explanation for what's going on with this kid. And new things are starting to present themselves. So all of a sudden, she's in a wheelchair because she cannot walk. And they're noticing, like you had said before, that her feet are starting to turn inward on each other as if she's pigeon-toed all of a sudden. It's sort of like a joint contracture, but it's actually called dystonia, where it's more of a nervous system response, and we're going to get into why that's happening too. She's also breaking out in lesions on her skin. She's getting these like random open areas on her skin. So
friggin' frightening.
Exactly. And then now, because she's like essentially bedridden and not walking, she's starting to deteriorate in other ways too. She can't move well, so she's starting to get these respiratory infections. Her muscles are atrophying. She's getting weaker. She's losing some weight. So she's getting all that sequela of a very debilitating illness is now hitting this 9-year-old. Maya would also often describe it as she felt like her skin was on fire and that she had zero energy and just all of these very vague complaints, which must have been terrifying as a child. And doctors still, however, with a lack of any strong data supporting any type of diagnosis that they were familiar with, start insinuating that maybe this is a behavioral thing.
And then again, maybe it's anxiety. This is also a very recent case.
Oh, yeah.
And so this was, what, 2015? So, I mean, think about all the, like, we've had so many cases before.
Yes.
Where they didn't have the diagnostic technology.
Exactly. But
so they're going through everything in their power and they can't figure it out.
Exactly. And
it's how rare it is.
This is a very rare thing that she eventually has, and we'll get into that. And it's just one of those things where there's not a ton of information or research available on this particular disease yet, because it really only was like discovered, quote unquote, in the 90s.
Great.
So it's one of those situations that is just tough for a lot of reasons. So nobody has an answer. And now things are starting to get blamed on anxiety. Maybe she needs to see a pediatric psychiatrist. But Beata knows there is a bigger picture here.
She knows that there is
an underlying diagnosis driving all of this, because it all started at the same time. All of it seems to be related. Something is being missed. So the thing about Beata is that she does not give the fuck up. I mean, this lady is like, this is not acceptable. We're just gonna keep trying to figure this out. So she researches every single thing that the doctors are telling her. She is a meticulous researcher and documenter.
I'm so proud of her.
Oh my fuck. So she researches every single symptom her daughter has. She researches every specialist in the general area, trying to come up with some answer for what is going on. What is our underlying big picture diagnosis here? Because nobody seems to be able to figure it out. She's documenting every encounter. She has videos of almost every medical encounter. And if you're curious to see some of those interactions, watch that documentary, because there is heavy documentation of her going to these specialists and being told, maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's, you know what I mean? Right. Like, So please,
the video, I mean, she was taking videos. Oh, of yeah, the videos appointments, which yes. I think is amazing.
Oh my gosh, it was amazing, and a lot of them are on there. It's really interesting to see. It's almost as if she's already getting labeled as this kid who has anxiety and psychosis and behavioral issues, and that's why she's not walking. And it's like nobody is willing to look past that and try to figure out what the zebra is. In medicine, there's a common saying that's when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. But
define that. I don't think I've ever heard this.
It's more of a medicine. It's in diagnostics, right? So when you're trying to figure out a diagnosis, if you're hearing hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras, means it is far more likely for it to be something common than it is for it to be something that is very uncommon, right? So
like a horse versus a zebra.
It's like when you have a headache, don't necessarily jump to I have glioblastoma.
Right.
You know what I mean? You it's far more likely that you have a migraine or a tension headache, right?
Hypertension, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's all in that same vein, right? But once you rule out all the horses, that's when you start thinking about the zebras, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So like, what's her zebra? What is this poor girl's zebra? This goes on for months, literal months. Her parents would recall that they would be listening to her cry and scream throughout the night, not sleeping because she was in such extreme pain. Jack and Beata would be up with her for hours at night trying to calm her down, still not have any answers as to what the hell is going on with her kid. It's like a parent's worst nightmare, like literal worst. This is my worst nightmare, being trapped in this situation where my kid is suffering and I can't help and mm-hmm. I don't have an answer. So like I cannot imagine how helpless you must feel in that scenario, because I mean I had, of course, to help my kids through like brief illnesses. And that's very upsetting to me as a parent.
And they're common brief illnesses, yes. too. And they know how to treat them. But your child is still like in agony.
It's miserable for 24 hours. Like when my kids have like a bad GI bug. Oh, my God. I'm like, please.
But you've had some good breathing ER trips with your youngest.
Of course,
that sound terrifying.
And that was terrifying enough. Yes. Having to live in this for months and not no be way. Able and nothing is helping. Like I just cannot even wrap my head around that. Mm-hmm. Beata, not giving up, keeps researching, keeps documenting. The records she keeps on all of this are absolutely impeccable, ridiculous, incredible. And it paints such a detailed picture of what this family went through, seeing doctor to doctor, getting no answers. And the scenario of not having any answers was just not acceptable to Jack and Beata. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the notes she kept, they're all trialing her on all these very heavy hitting meds. Like she was getting tramadol, clonidine, trazodone, all to like help her sleep and help her pain and like essentially mask all those symptoms, but nothing is really working. And it looked like they even trialed IVIG infusions, which like they don't even know what they're dealing with. Nothing worked. You know what I mean? So there's actually a video recording that I want to quote here of Maya and her mom in the clinic with the immunologist that she was seeing, who stated to her, quote, "To be honest, I don't even really know what's going on with her still. And kids can say, you know, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And then they feel that way during an anxiety attack." Mm. So that assumption that mm-hmm. all of this is all psychological and anxiety related is still there, still following Maya from clinic to clinic, doctor to doctor, when she's sitting there in a wheelchair with lesions on her skin and dystonic lower
you
limbs.
You can't make that up.
No, you can't. And you can just hear the frustration and disappointment in their voices when they respond after he says that. And it's like heartbreaking. And there's this little clip after he leaves the room and Maya looks at her mom. This is a video. Maya looks at her mom and says, "It's not anxiety, mom." And Beata just responds, "I know, baby, stay calm. He's going to figure it out." Mm-hmm. That's what she says. Just trying to build her daughter up and keep
her
calm.
Right.
When inside, she's probably panicking.
Correct. So she's probably just as pissed off, but she doesn't want to freak out her daughter.
Wondering, is my daughter going to die? And we're never going to have answers. Because like that is a very real possibility at this point. So Beata doesn't go to bed at the end of the day. She just continues to pound away at the research. She's staying up. She's at the computer. She's still researching. Finally, she comes across a specialist by the name of Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick, and he was out of the University of South Florida College of Medicine in Tampa, And he had established a research institute and treatment center specializing in a disease called CRPS, or Complex Regional Pain Syndrome. And based on Beata's research, she started wondering if Maya was fitting the picture with a child of that of a child with CRPS. So they set up an appointment to the clinic with meet with him. And so, of course, she's taking video, and actually he is taking his own video for his records and educational purposes.
Because again, it's so rare, so new. He's exactly. Studying it.
So of all of her, so he goes through this thorough exam, and I know I keep referencing this documentary, but there's of course a video, like, please watch it because it is just, it is so wild to see.
Well, it's very well done.
It's very well done. And he says, okay, we're going to, you know, I'm going to take a video. We're going to use this to help educate other kids and teach other kids about this. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. And like, it's a video of him and Maya, and they're going through sort of this detailed review of systems and history and one of her symptoms. And he has her do all of these exercises and movements where her range of motion is very limited. She can't really lift up her arm.
Right.
She can't really wiggle her toes. And she is still wheelchair bound. So he goes through all of this data, through this complex history on both of them. And he is finally able to give them a diagnosis of complex regional pain syndrome. And for the first time, Maya and her mom look like there's like this tiny little bit of hope and at least an answer.
But then so, now what? Like, okay, so exactly. Now we think we know what it is, but then what?
So let's talk about complex regional pain syndrome a little bit. So this is a rare disease. So it's no wonder that nobody really picked up on this right away. Mm-hmm. And this is something that nobody really sees every day, except for maybe Dr. Kirkpatrick. And for that reason, it often does leave families and children who suffer from this sort of like going down the PCP rabbit hole and, you know, referral after referral and not getting answers for months or years at a time, mm-hmm. because nobody really is well versed enough in this to be able to diagnose it. So complex regional pain syndrome is actually a broad term that covers any long-lasting pain or inflammation that can happen after some kind of medical event or injury to an area. Mm. Say you burn yourself or sprain your ankle. I mean, it really can be that minor of an injury that sets this off. There are several different types of complex regional pain syndrome. There's CRPS type 1, which occurs after an illness or an injury. But it's not associated with any specific nerve damage. And then there's type 2, which is associated with like visible damage to a specific nerve. So, like I said, the injury can be something as simple as a sprain or a cut or a burn. And the pain that people experience is very disproportionate to what appears on the outside. So they have pain that is like way beyond normal.
So excruciating. And yes. It looks like it shouldn't be that bad.
Exactly. So that's why these people are often labeled as anxious or having a, you know, mental health issues, because it's like, I don't see any reason why you should be having right. so much pain. Your knee looks fine. Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. it can also cause changes in the colors of the skin or skin texture or temperature. It can cause swelling to one arm, one leg, or one set of limbs. There's typically not a whole lot that's visible from the outside. Studies have shown that the really severe cases tend to be longer lasting and can be very debilitating and can even last a lifetime. And CRPS can be an acute thing where it's more short term or lasting like, you know, less than 3 months or so, but then it mm-hmm. can also be chronic and lasting a lot longer. When diagnosed in younger people, like preteens and teenagers, is actually a high likelihood of recovery, like complete recovery from CRPS. But then if you come down with it as an adult, that can be years, like years and years down the road that you're still having discomfort.
Wow.
So it's tough really to know what the prognosis is until time kind of tells us. So symptoms include unprovoked or sudden pain that could be constant or with activity, often described as burning or pins and needles sensations, or long-lasting pain after use or contact with a certain limb. And it can also, like I said, cause changes in how the skin looks a little bit over time. And it can cause lesions to open and have like rashes and raised areas or open areas on the skin.
That's the part that gets me.
I know, it's wild. And then it can also change the way you sweat, the way your hair grows, the way your nails grow, like all very weird, interesting stuff like that. And then it can also cause impaired muscle strength and movement disorders. And a common finding, especially in preteens, is the dystonia in the lower limbs. And that is like sort of a clinical red flag mm-hmm. for CRPS in that age group. So that's that fixed abnormal posture or the returning of her feet, like the turn, the inturning of her feet that we were seeing. So this ended up being a very, very diagnostic clinical finding for Maya in this case. So the nerve pain is very tough to control. Nerve pain in general usually is very difficult to control. So there are several different approaches. I mean, you can try things like narcotics, anti-inflammatories, but like that's not typically, it doesn't typically like do what it really needs to do in order to like get these people some quality of life. So most of these people actually end up in like rehab plans or getting physical therapy from muscle atrophy and dystonia because people just cannot move. They're so debilitated from this. Some people actually end up with spinal cord stimulators or neurostimulators wow. implanted to try to control the symptoms. I mean, it can get like very, very severe.
Wow.
For children, especially with CRPS, not a ton is known about it. Like I said, it's really only been like an actual diagnosis since the 1990s. Symptoms have been described over the like past 100 plus years or so. So, I mean, I'm sure it's been around forever.
Yeah.
But again, that's why patients end up suffering, you know, will go down that for years and years going down that rabbit hole of nobody can figure out what's wrong with me. Everybody thinks I'm crazy because I look fine, but I feel terrible and I can't walk.
Right.
So research out there is pretty limited. Dr. Kirkpatrick and his clinic are actually one of the leading research institutes on childhood CRPS in the country. And what's come out of the patient trials is that the best treatment and the most successful treatment for complex regional pain syndrome is ketamine. So ketamine is a drug that it's not without its own controversy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues floating around with ketamine, and we'll get into that.
That's part of what brought this whole thing to light, too.
Exactly. You
know, like...
Exactly. So ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic, which is used in the medical setting for induction and maintenance of anesthesia. It can also be used as a treatment for severe depression and pain management. And it's actually a fairly new medication. It's not been around for a ton of years. And at anesthetic doses, ketamine induces this like state of trance. Like it's like a trance-like anesthesia or sedation. So, And then in different doses, it can be used for pain relief. And it actually has been incredibly successful at treating treatment-resistant depression and pain issues.
The depression one is interesting.
It is. And actually, it's been, you know, people actually have come forward saying it's like, you know, when I've been so depressed for years. I've tried every medication combination there was out there. And finally, ketamine infusions are the thing that helped me. It's wild. So the distinguishing feature that makes it more attractive to use as an anesthetic is that it tends to preserve breathing and airway reflexes. As long as you don't overdo it. If you way overdo it, it can absolutely abate your respiratory drive and your airway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lower, like, sub-anesthetic doses, it really does help, in, like I said, in that treatment-resistant depression and pain. Treatments like a single IV dose of ketamine can actually have positive effects on depression and pain for, like, weeks at a time. Ketamine also is abused as a recreational drug, and it can be found on the street in crystalline powder form or liquid form, and is often referred to as Special K or simply K.
I feel like that's, I mean, we're getting down the road a bit, but yeah. I feel like that was the big issue for the doctors.
It is. Yeah, it is for sure. So ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist, meaning that it results in an analgesia by essentially preventing the central sensitization in our neurons. Basically, that means it interferes with the pain transmission within the spinal cord. So in terms of alleviating depression, that mechanism is not very well understood. It's thought that maybe that receptor antagonism also results in like the abatement of depression, but thus far human trials on oral NMDA antagonists have not proven very significant treatments for depression, so we're still actively like investigating all of that. But with that nerve pathway to the spinal cord being interrupted, it's kind of thought that the reason the ketamine works so well for CRPS is that it's putting a wall between the pain impulse and our spinal cord and sort of resetting the entire nervous system.
Wow.
So when our nerves are misfiring like that, it's sort of like giving them a clean slate.
Hmm.
So while all of this sounds excellent, like I said, ketamine has faced some controversy, even outside of the fact that it's a recreational drug that's abused and sold on the street. It can be habit forming. So if it's given consistently over a long period of time, you're eventually going to build up a tolerance and a habit for it. So while people are taking ketamine long term for very real psychiatric disorders and very true pain disorders, if we're prescribing these long term courses of ketamine, you know, what other risks are we exposing them to?
A lot.
And then the FDA has actually issued warnings to this effect and has stressed that the FDA has not approved ketamine for a treatment of psychiatric disorders in particular.
No.
They have not approved that as a treatment. And they also warn that using it outside of like a medically monitored setting can be very high risk. And if you start crossing from the therapeutic dose into that anesthetic dose, you might start to look at things like the respiratory depression, the breathing problems. Mm-hmm. So, that all can be potentially life-threatening. And then the FDA has actually stated they received reports from patients taking oral ketamine for psychiatric indications who are starting to experience respiratory depression at home and have needed like ER transfers for that. Ketamine is actually used in like a pre-hospital setting as well by EMS providers. And there was actually a situation fairly recently in which I believe it was like an agitated patient was being cared for by EMS providers. And per their protocols, they gave a very high dose of IM ketamine, and this patient actually ended up dying.
Oh, no.
And those EMS workers actually faced criminal charges for it was negligent homicide or something. I'm not 100% sure, but I remember reading about this in the news. So it was like this big thing. So while the data, sorry, my dog is barking. So while the data is showing some promise in pain management and psychiatric disorders, we don't have a ton of information. It is still a risky drug.
Absolutely.
And that's why a lot of medical providers are more hesitant around it, because of course there's a lot of risk associated and there's a lot of negativity in the media around ketamine specifically.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of information.
I now know everything there is to know about ketamine.
I think you do. So when Maya was seen by Dr. Kirkpatrick, for him, it was very clear, very simple, very clear case of CRPS. I mean, this was very clear cut for him. So finally, the family has answers. They finally have a diagnosis. This one actually makes sense. They have an explanation for everything. Potentially, we have a drug that could really, truly help do more than just mask the symptoms for a brief period of time while she continues to, you know, get better. She might actually make some real progress. So they start some outpatient treatments. They start giving her ketamine orally and IV. It's helping a little bit, but it's not helping enough. And it becomes clear that her case has become so advanced that they may need to be a lot more aggressive in her treatment for this. Because of the severity of Maya's case, Dr. Kirkpatrick recommends a pretty extreme treatment for her. And what he offered,
this was pretty alarming.
This was wild. This is actually the first time I've heard of this. What he offered was a 5-day ketamine coma. And this treatment is so controversial that it's not even actually performed in the United States. So what the family would have to do was fly to another country to be able to get this done. And Dr. Kirkpatrick felt very strongly that if we could get her through this very tough period and get her this ketamine coma, you know, it would be very distressing to be in another country. It would be very it would be a risky situation. This is a very extreme medical treatment that is not without risk. But he thought, you know what? She's going to do very well. She is otherwise very healthy. And this will give her the best chance at a recovery.
Putting all their faith into one doctor.
Oh,
they're putting all their faith into him. And like, it's the U.S. doesn't even allow this. Right. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty advanced in our treatments. Yes. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
That, what a scary decision to have to make.
Oh, my gosh. As a parent, like, but and so like, I'll start with this. So the ketamine coma is exactly what it sounds like. So what happens is patients are hospitalized into an ICU. They're given approximately 50 times the normal anesthetic dose of ketamine. And of course, they are placed on a ventilator with a breathing tube because this completely abates their respiratory drive. Mm-hmm. They're closely monitored on a heart monitor. Their hemodynamics are carefully monitored, and they can be given medication to help control the blood pressure response and the heart rate response. And after 5 days, this coma is lifted and patients notice a very substantial improvement in their symptoms.
How do you think they determined that 5 days?
Isn't that wild?
Isn't it weird? Like, how do you just all of a sudden decide 5 days is the day versus six mm-hmm. or four?
Like, yeah, I mean, it's wild, right?
Studies, but yeah. It's just, I don't know. It always amazes me.
It's very interesting, isn't it? So when they had by the time they had finally made it to Dr. Kirkpatrick's clinic, this was September of 2015. So it had been months of debilitating mm-hmm. discomfort, and she was deteriorating. So they felt like, you know, it's watch our daughter continue to deteriorate or give her this chance, which might actually really help her in the long term.
Nothing else is helping.
Nothing else is helping. So they decide to take the risk and they flew to Monterrey, Mexico, which is the only area of the world that this treatment is available in.
Friggin' insane.
And feeling as though they really had no other options, they all packed up and they flew to Monterrey in November of 2015 to place their daughter in a ketamine-induced coma for 5 days. And they recall this having been one of the most terrifying experiences of their life.
Imagine going through those 5 days.
Jesus, no, I cannot. I mean, it's like wild to me. So, of course, Maya's mother, being who she is, documents the entire thing meticulously. There are video logs of each and every procedure, her induction, where she was very scared, asking for her mom. She was saying things like, "When I wake up, will I be normal?" Which was like heartbreaking. And then, of course, Beata's like, "Of course, and you are normal." Like, just like totally just, you know, putting those mom pants
you're
on.
Already and normal.
You know, when she's probably terrified and, you know, she's just encouraging her daughter
to stay
strong.
She doesn't
even know
if her daughter's going to wake up.
Exactly. I mean, this must have just been absolutely terrifying. So this long coma period begins. They bring her out of it as planned. She wakes up and she's better. Her pain is better. She woke up saying, "I'm hungry." And she really had no outward complications from this. Her parents were absolutely elated.
I'm hungry.
Days later, after they return, they go to see Dr. Kirkpatrick as a follow-up in the clinic. And again, he's taking a video and having her go through all those same functional exercises that we saw in that first video.
I was amazed with how high she could lift her
arms. She's whipping her arms around. Yes. She's wiggling her toes. She's having no pain. I mean, there's still a little pain, but she is 90% better. I mean, it's like wild. She's moving. She's smiling. She's interacting. I mean, a vast, vast, vast improvement. So her pain, again, was by no means gone, but she became a lot more functional. She had less headaches, less abdominal pain, less leg pain. She was able to tolerate things like therapy for strengthening. And her parents finally had some relief in knowing that they had a diagnosis and that this was an option for treatment and that it can help. And Emma did have some minor lasting effects, like some short-term memory loss. She had a little bit of visual fuzziness, but she said all of that was totally worth it if it meant that I didn't have to be in excruciating pain every single day. So Dr. Kirkpatrick's services were outside of their insurance network. So much of this treatment for Maya was being paid for essentially out of pocket by the Kowalskis.
Could
so
you imagine?
I literally can't. So, I mean, all of these travel expenses, I mean, everything is so incredibly expensive.
To get to Mexico?
Yes. So, unfortunately, the Kowalskis really were not in a place to keep up with Dr. Kirkpatrick, so he was able to make a recommendation for a colleague of his who was in their insurance network, fellow anesthesiologist and specialist in CRPS, Dr. Ashraf Hanna. And Dr. Hanna was able to prescribe oral ketamine for Maya to take it home. So she was on a regimen of taking pretty high doses, very high doses of ketamine at home. So things seem to be getting better. She's participating in therapy. She's making gains. She's still spending a lot of time in a wheelchair, but she's able to move her legs. She's kind of, you know, doing some exercises. She's starting to stand. She's taking steps here and there. The dystonia was straightening out. She's able to get back to school because she can actually tolerate
schools.
Could
you imagine the high that they were living
on? Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
To see that everything was, like, becoming undone.
Yes, exactly. She's finally getting back to, like, some semblance of normalcy. So fast forward again. October 7th, 2016. A big hurricane is ripping through Florida at this very moment, and the Kowalskis are woken to screaming coming from Maya's room. She starts having excruciating pain in her legs and her abdomen, and she's shaking. She's crying. It's clear that she's starting a relapse after this period of recovery that she's been having, which is something that can happen. They're giving her oral doses of ketamine that they have at home. It's not enough. And her parents know this is not going to be enough. They know what she needs, which is high dose IV ketamine to get through this. So this escalates to the point where Maya is obviously in massive distress. So they make the decision to load her up into the car in the middle of the night, in the middle
of a hurricane.
Hurricane Matthew, which is ripping up the east coast of Florida, causing massive wind gusts, rains. There were bridges that were out. There were trees that were down. I mean, it was not like safe to be out driving in this moment.
Right.
And so they ended up bringing her to the hospital, and where they ended up was the pediatric emergency room at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in Tampa, Florida. And this,
you would think, could be the right place to be.
Is sort of where the true nightmare begins for this entire family. So that is where I'm going to leave us.
Maya is relapsing.
And she is
driving in the middle of a hurricane
at Johns Hopkins in the ER. And this is episode two is going to be rough because it's when we get into what happens in the hospital.
I'm going to get so angry.
You're going to be so angry. You're just going to, whatever device you're listening on, you're just going to like, chuck it. Just chuck it out the window because it's so maddening for this poor family. I mean, the pigeonhole, the railroad, whatever you want to call it, is just so sad. And it just gets sadder and sadder and sadder.
The only one that was taking care of Maya was mom and dad.
Mom and dad were taking care of Maya. Nobody else was taking care of Maya.
It's pretty sad.
Or her family, the rest of her family. Who, I mean, this derailed everything for them.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we have a couple more parts to go, but this story is pretty devastating.
Oh, yeah, it is. So with that,
thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to keep finding us and seeing what we're up to, you can search for us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast also.
You can search for us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, it's super fun there. You can search us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast. It's super fun.
We have parties over there.
There are literal parties. It's great.
If you want to send us any of your crazy stories, ideas, suggestions, or feedback, anything that you want to say to us, you can email us at midcrimes@gmail.com.
We literally love hearing from you guys. Also, I meant to mention this in the beginning, but we got some feedback, some constructive feedback. Well, I did, not we. I did, on how I say exactly and exactly right way too often. And I never actually realized this. And then now that I'm thinking about it now, I'm like, fuck, how many times did I say exactly just now? I think I said it about a million times. So I'm sorry.
How many times did I sniffle?
I am trying to manage the exactlies. I will work on that. Thank you.
Exactly. We love the constructive feedback. It's great. It helps us to know that you're actually listening and you want us to get better. We appreciate it.
We do want to get better, for sure.
It's pretty cool.
Peace up, A-Town.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Happy Nurses Week. Happy Teachers Week. Happy Mother's Day. Happy National Nursing Home Week.
Stay safe out there, for fuck's sake.
We're crying out loud.